Two guys with no credentials. Reviewing Rolling
Stone 500 greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us here again at the SoundLogic Podcast. And today we're discussing album number 91 on Rolling Stone magazine's Top 500 Greatest Albums list. This is Darkness on the Edge of Town by Bruce Springsteen.
One of the things I do with my stay-at-home dad hours is volunteer at a free student coffee shop in State College at a church called St. Paul's United Methodist Church. Keeps me connected with college students, something I used to do all the time, and it's a lot of fun. And one day, I walked in, and people were talking about Bruce Springsteen. I thought, okay, my ears perked up because, you know, he's got a few albums on this list. And it turns out that my friend Greg, who's the pastor at St. Paul's United Methodist Church, is a Bruce Springsteen fan. We got to talking a little bit more and realized we both had this similar kind of journey arc with Bruce, in that we grew up not really thinking much of the guy, perhaps because of a few of his very overplayed tracks like Born in the USA, and misunderstood that song to be a patriotic ballad when it really isn't. And sort of later in life discovered a love and appreciation for Bruce Springsteen. Greg was kind enough to join us this evening as we do a review of this album. He's fresh off just a few weeks back of seeing Bruce and the E Street Band live, so he's still got that kind of glow with him. And he spent the afternoon poring over music and books and charts and graphs, and has done way more research, I think, in one afternoon than Mike and I do in a general month or two on the SoundLogic podcast. So we're really happy to have Greg here with us today. Greg is a fellow minister, but also someone who cares a lot about making faith practical, about peace and social justice issues, about being more tolerant and inclusive in faith spaces, and a real kindred spirit. Discovering our mutual appreciation for The Boss has only deepened that respect and admiration. Greg, thanks so much for being here with us.
Wow, thank you. Thanks for those really kind words, Ben. I appreciate that. I'm so glad to be here, guys. I do love Bruce Springsteen, and like you said, I have a similar sort of trajectory of coming to him later in my life, and it's really been a fun journey for me of kind of falling in love with his music and even just kind of being mesmerized by his whole thing, his whole story and persona and maybe a quest for authenticity. But anyway, I'm excited to be here and talk about this and share this conversation with you guys.
I thought a good starting point would be to hear a little bit more about your discovery of Bruce specifically before we get to this album, because you are someone who's actually lived in New Jersey. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm going to share some regret about that, though. So, I mean, like you said, I don't regret living in Jersey, though. Like you said, I just kind of had a very one-dimensional view of who Bruce Springsteen was based on some radio airplay and just some like cultural, I don't know, understanding. But so when I was in New Jersey and everyone sort of prayed to the Father, Son, Holy Spirit and Bruce Springsteen, I kind of rejected that too. Like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to buy into that. You know, I will say that in after 9/11, in the next year, he released an album that was really aimed at sort of trying to heal some of the neighborhoods and the people that were going through some real stuff, having lost first responders and people in the towers. And I remember being sort of moved by that and just like, that's kind of cool. Like taking the position that he has to do something, but I didn't really I still wasn't really into the music. Right. It wasn't until we moved back to Pennsylvania years later, that my wife Shannon, was really kind of digging him and introducing me to him a little bit, that I really started to enjoy him. I bought her tickets to go see Bruce at a show in Hershey And so I immersed myself in his music to like just kind of get familiar with it. And that's when it was like 2014 that I really just kind of like, oh, this guy's incredible. I wish that I had known this when I was in New Jersey.
That's awesome. You have a bit of a journey to this album as well, right? A few years ago, you wouldn't have said this is your favorite Bruce album, but just in the last little while, actually, something has switched for you. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, it's because you guys asked me to join you here, actually. You said, you knew that we had this thing in common and that I was pretty passionate about Bruce Springsteen and asked me to come and talk about this album. And I was like, I'd love to talk about Bruce Springsteen. Darkness on the Edge of Town, I don't know, whatever, it's okay. I kind of just knew it as the album that two of my least favorite Bruce Springsteen songs were on. And I knew a bunch of the tracks, but I guess I hadn't really ever taken much time to encounter it just as a piece, as an album in and of itself. But of course, I started immersing myself in it in preparation for this. And it wasn't long that I was like, oh, hold on, I've been missing a whole thing here. Yeah. And I mean, I'm telling you, it has moved up to top three album for me in the Springsteen canon for sure. So that's been kind of a fun little journey for me. So that's part of the gift you guys gave me asking me to be here. Thanks for that.
That's really cool and so recent. And I don't want to take away from that comment. Ben and I have encountered that on this journey so many times where something we had written off or hadn't given time to and thought, well, I guess I have to listen to it now. Well, let's go through the exercise of just doing it and then being surprised by, wow, or I missed that before. Or that's really cool. Really, really cool. Especially because you were already a Springsteen fan. To find another gem there is just really awesome.
It is. It is. So thanks, guys.
Oh, you're welcome.
Absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't be, I wouldn't describe myself as appreciating Bruce Springsteen at all until we got to Born to Run on this list. And picking up that copy and getting it on vinyl. It's really changed a lot about something I never would have thought I would do was tolerate sitting through multiple hours of a Netflix rambling of Bruce telling his story and playing music. Like, that sounds painful if you're not a fan, right? But suddenly I'm sitting down and savoring it and reading his biography and all kinds of stuff. So it's funny how those things change. But we are here to talk about a specific album here tonight. Should we jump into the details, Mike? Do you want to start there, or do you have more questions for Greg before we take off? Okay.
No, let's do some details now, and then I do have some questions, but I think they'll be appropriate a little later. But let's talk about some of the details, the backdrop of this album.
Details.
Darkness on the Edge of Town was released June 2nd, 1978, was his fourth studio album. Oh, I got that right? I thought it was, fourth studio album by Bruce Springsteen. He wrote all the music. He's the only one credited for all the songs. Charted, went to number 5 in the US, 14 in the UK. And it was top 20 in 10 countries, including, we always have to say, because I'm still living here, number 7 in Canada. Sales to date, sales numbers can be tricky to really get the real number, but somewhere around 4 million. Not nearly as high as a Born to Run or Born in the USA, I don't think, but still nothing to laugh at. Really, this is significant, and if you guys want to speak to this after I mention it, you can, because I don't know a lot about it, but this record follows a number of years of legal disputes that Springsteen had with him and his former manager. And because of the legal case, he didn't record, or he wasn't able to record. So what he was doing when he was on the road, he was writing a lot. And we've read that he had somewhere between 40 and 70 songs ready to go when it came time to record again. Do you guys have anything else to add to that before I kind of move on to something else? Because that's a pretty unique situation.
Yeah, I think it was just on our re-rank episode, Mike, where you were talking about Taylor Swift trying to like reclaim some of her back catalog. I think it was like the success of Born to Run and coming through all that and realizing you still didn't have very much money. Like you're still kind of a struggling right. artist, kind of realize like what's going on here.
Yeah.
And digging into some of the books made him realize, oh, the structure of my contract is bad. And it's basically because this one guy has stuck some things by me here. He goes into a lot more detail in his book that is out there in pretty public knowledge, I think, but kind of a painful breakup with this guy who supported him from the beginning, realizing that he wasn't as supportive as he once thought. Do I got that right, Greg?
Yeah, you definitely do. I just want to flesh it out just a bit, though, to say, because
sure.
I think it's significant to note that it wasn't merely a contract dispute. So Bruce had signed a really bad contract with this guy. His name is Mike Appel. And Bruce wasn't seeing, you're right, Bruce wasn't seeing the money that probably he should have seen after the success of Born to Run. Mm. But it was more than a contract dispute. This was a gut-wrenching sort of divorce of a deep friendship. And so some of what you've got when the lyrics are actually written and the songs recorded on Darkness is not just a kind of like, oh, finally I get to record and write again. But it's like there's been some real emotional stuff that's been gone through, and you can hear echoes of it for sure in the lyrics, and even in, I think, the music, in Bruce's sort of groaning and howling, there's a pain, and some of that has to do with what he went through those 3 years.
Wow.
It was so bad that like he didn't actually own any of the music, is that right? Like it was there was something about the ownership of those first three albums that was in question because of how bad the contract was.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not clear on all the details. I do know that when he had talked to another friend, I think it was John Landau, who introduced him to a lawyer just to take a look at the contracts that he had signed previously. And these lawyers looked at it and they were like, this is the worst contract we've ever seen.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's sad. That's heartbreaking. You know, that's too bad. And it's funny because I've thought about this. We've talked about other things, Ben, different situations where it's so bittersweet as an audience member here that we benefit from the art that's created, from the hardships of what someone's gone through personally, right? Like we go, oh, this, it's so rich with emotion. You can hear it. You can feel it. Not that we say that trivially, but you know, we have it and we can enjoy it. And we do because of what they've gone through, and they've had
the pain,
and the transparency and the openness to share it with us, which is an honor. But yeah, it's so interesting. We hear we bounce around like this, Greg, a lot. But I think about, you know, Beyonce's Lemonade, where she shares you know this narrative of this incredibly emotional personal experience she's had, right. and we get to experience that. That art so beautifully done. Anyways, wow.
Yeah. I wasn't aware. Too, right? Like,
oh my gosh.
We've got this like haunting song.
Don't get me started.
Don't get me started. Right? And it's beautiful. You're like, oh, you had to go through the process of giving up a child to write that song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
You just say Joni Mitchell's Blue and I've got goosebumps already. So,
wow. Guys, maybe one last piece on that, just to give context, is that so the result of all of that was suits and counter lawsuits, but the effect on Bruce was that he was not allowed to record. The lawsuit kept him from recording, so that's a big part of the 3-year delay and the prolific amount of songs that he was writing because he couldn't go and record them, so he just kept writing. Yeah. Hmm.
Now, I have something here that says that he gave. He gave some of these songs to other artists.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a really critical mind for like what he wanted on this album.
Right.
And if it didn't fit sort of a vision, if it didn't fit like a temperature or a mood or a vision for what this Darkness on the Edge of Town was going to be like, he's like, nope, not for this one, and would pass it on to other folks.
Like I've read here, he gave, like you said, he sold them, right? He must have sold them.
I don't know. This is pulled right from Wikipedia, so I don't know if they were sold or passed on with permission.
Right.
The biggest one is the Because of the Night song to Patti Smith. And my understanding is they just gave that to her. That's my understanding.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
That's cool. What a cool community. Yeah, so really
some
interesting.
Were held over. There's a couple that are listed here. Southside Johnny and Asbury Jukes. I don't know who they are, but passed on a couple to them. One to Robert Gordon and the Pointer Sisters. And yeah, a bunch of other people. You can see the whole list in Wikipedia if you go there.
Yeah.
Some stuff stuck around and wound up on future recordings. And eventually a lot of the stuff that he was tinkering with got released in bootlegs or official compilations of B-sides and outtakes and things like that. So I think we know a lot of the, whatever it is, 40 to 70 songs by now.
Right.
But
yeah,
but it really was sort of chiseled down to make these 10 tracks on this album here.
He released a bunch of them on an album called The Promise, which is the Darkness on the Edge of Town sessions.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it's interesting. It's an interesting listen because, Ben, you were mentioning like he had a very specific vision of what he wanted on the album. And when you listen to these other tracks, you can really hear, like you can hear how that didn't really fit in with the vision. You know, so you can kind of experience the process with them of what was it that he needed for the feel of this album.
I don't want to play too much of my hand right away, but I wasn't grabbed as aggressively as Born to Run grabbed me by this one. And I think because of some of the intentional darkness of this one, it doesn't have... You can tell he's not aiming for the radio airplay hook with what winds up on this album. And so that makes me want to go and listen to those other tracks to see if there's some remnants of the Born to Run sound that I like so much left there, or if it's sort of where he goes from here that you find it. And either way, I should really go check out The Promise.
our next segment here is the cover, the album cover art. Of course, we love to talk about the album covers, especially, you know, most of what we discuss is in the vinyl age, so you've got this huge canvas that's on. Look it up if you're not familiar with it. It's cool as you're listening to the podcast, you know, look at the image so you know. And this is interesting. It's a full shot, you know, kind of torso up a Bruce, just front and center. Very classic, white t-shirt, black jacket, with some maybe Venetian blinds behind or something there. And then the font. I like this font. It's like a typewriter style font.
Yep.
And the text is in black and it's kind of faded as if it was on a typewriter. Really, really interesting, nice touch. Bruce Springsteen, and then underneath and slightly indented Darkness on the Edge of Town. Kind of lines up with the frame of the window frame there.
I don't know.
I expect that's intentional.
Each blind, it looks like, has a line of text.
Yeah, yeah, that must have been the intention there. Certainly much better design than some of the 90s album covers we've discussed, which are just weird. But the font reminds me, I think, many artists, I think in the 90s there was a resurgence of this typewriter font. Right off the top of my head, Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill is that typewriter sprawled. Sprawled, but you get this font a lot. Anyways, there's some. I don't know, Greg. Do you want to talk about some of this background on this shot here? I don't know.
First of all, do you get a lot of compliments on your descriptions of the album covers? Because you do a fine job.
I'm glad you say that, Greg. Because I've never got any feedback one way or the other. So sometimes I wonder, like, oh man, am I just rambling? And if someone's just not looking at this in their head, they must have no clue what I'm talking about. So I appreciate that. I do enjoy doing it. So thank you.
Good. It's like one of my favorite parts of the show, man.
That's great. Wow. Making my day. Thanks, Greg.
I tune in for the album cover descriptions.
Well, thank you. Oh, that's very encouraging, actually.
Well, good. Good.
Wow.
I mean, I think the thing about the cover is that, well, like Ben said, I don't want to give away too much of my hand either here, but But it for me, if I compare it to the previous one, if you compare it to Born to Run, mm-hmm. where he's grinning a million-dollar grin and leaning on Clarence, and he looks delighted, and everything's just a blast and a party. And then you look at this guy. I mean, it's Bruce on the front, and he's got this almost faraway look in his eye.
Yeah,
it's like he's chewing on something in his mind. He doesn't look necessarily mad or sad, but there's some kind of depth in his face, right? And the story is that this was an unknown photographer, New Jersey photographer at the time, who took the pictures in his own Jersey home. It's like everywhere in New Jersey, this wallpaper and Venetian blind, right? But when Bruce finally saw the photos, he said this guy on the front of the record, that's the guy my songs are about. Like that's the look I was going for.
I really like that. He's you're right. He's got a tired, worn down look about him. I'm really glad that you contrasted that to Born to Run, because there's just this fire. He's got his guitar. He's, you know, it's like this is a successful performer. This is really the essence of a lot of Bruce's music. This is the working man, right? This is the kind of beat down, everyday guy. It's a really neat effect.
I don't want to read too much into it, but one of my favorite stories from his autobiography is him going along the boardwalk in Jersey Shore and searching for the bar with the least amount of people in it and telling the owner, if you let my band play here, we'll bring in people. You don't have any people right now, so you need our band. Like that kind of confidence and swagger leads to Born to Run, I think. In this picture, it looks like the 3 years of being in court proceedings has taken a lot of that, like, I'm the king kind of swagger out of him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he's grizzled. Like, I think Bruce has always sounded like he's 55, but this one especially, like, he looks aged in a way that, like you said, Greg, he doesn't have that million-dollar grin on.
Yeah, and that persona that you're talking about, that really he comes to embody fully throughout his career, it starts here. Like, we think of it as just Bruce Springsteen, but really this is the moment where that begins. It was not really there on Born to Run. Born to Run, he was just leaving town and having a good time.
Yeah. Yeah, Greg, that makes me think about kind of before we get into the music, there's one more thing I wanted to touch on because I think it's significant. And I read something today as I was preparing, and I feel really ignorant that this, I didn't really, wasn't aware of this. The genre, the heartland rock, which was a phrase that until today I hadn't really heard. And so what is that? Okay, so I looked into it and seeing the other artists, Tom Petty, John Mellencamp, and Bruce Springsteen, about exactly what we're talking about. The whole idea of heartland rock is the blue collar everyday American, especially in, you know, I would say Eastern Seaboard. You know, you think about the, especially coming through the, you know, post-war to probably the 80s, you know, in the Cleveland area, Buffalo area, Jersey, all these places with factories and steelworks, and you know, there's the factory song in this album too. All of a sudden I'm reading, and this is a genre that I've never researched, never even heard of, but makes perfect sense when I think about this album, about Bruce and about those other artists. Now the image on the cover and the persona makes so much sense. So that's, again, just me and my ignorance and kind of just putting together another piece of puzzle. Are you guys familiar? I mean, probably you would say yes, because you've done it. Are you familiar with this idea of heartland rock, or do you have any other insight on it that I obviously don't?
I wouldn't say I'm any sort of expert on it. I mean, I've heard that term associated with the exact artist that you mentioned, and with this album. What genre was Born to Run called, though? Was it wasn't considered heartland rock? No,
and what the very little that I read just today was that exactly what you said. It really comes out of this, and then into the river, and then kind of peaks at Born in the USA, and really he's not the backbone of, but he is probably the best example of an artist that personifies this subgenre of heartland rock. Right. And then it really fizzles out into the late 80s into more Americana, whatever,
right,
whatever exactly that is. Yeah. But it's kind of this kind of very specific subgenre in a very specific time, you know, like late 70s, starting with really with this album and the success of this album, although it wasn't as commercially successful as Born to Run. It's a totally different tone, as we've already discussed. Yeah. Totally different tone. And really, I think it's inspired by Bob Dylan and others in the 60s. It's inspired by that, but then is written for kind of a new generation 15 years later, going through what it's like to be that working class blue collar American in this. Yeah, and the geographic area too, and like what we talked about, kind of, I think, you know, Eastern Seaboard, East Coast, Northern East Coast, working at factories, working at that life that so many millions of Americans could relate to, what that life is like. And I think, again, not getting ahead of ourselves, but isn't that one of the great appeals of the Boss, that he's the average American. You can relate to the stuff he talks about because we all do that.
Yeah. Well, and I think he had a choice. Like, he was really enamored with punk music and talks extensively about the influence that The Clash and other bands had on him as a young artist. But I think if he had gone in that direction, he would have lost some of the authenticity that he's known for. He probably could have done that well and found a persona there, but it would have been just that. I think this pivot to this heartland rock or whatever is like him, this leaning into who he is, and all those descriptive words that you gave there, Mike. It's a really fascinating intentional choice, and maybe one that was brought on by the success of Born to Run. His first album, man, is so different. A lot of like R&B influence, and like doesn't sound like what's on the radio today about Bruce Springsteen. He's still got that gravelly voice, but very, very different. Trying to find himself, I think, certainly. You've got to have some confidence to say, I'm just going to be me and do this thing, rather than I'm going to try and make something that's more radio friendly or, you know, fits with the vibe of the music that's on the radio at that time. But late 70s, early 80s, you know, could have gone in a whole lot of different directions. We're not that far from yacht rock instead of heartland rock. Man, you could have a whole different kind of Bruce Springsteen.
Can you imagine?
Oh, and it's the same. It's the same time frame, really. Like,
yeah.
You know, you see that in, well, kind of 70, I guess 76 ish. That again is another subgenre that's a very short period of time, really. So interesting.
I just want to say, though, that it's not, Ben used the word authenticity. I think that's really important here, is, you know, a couple of these songs, and we're going to get into a little bit of that, I guess, but he's like actually connecting to his roots, right? Born to Run, he was born to run. He went down Thunder Road, right? Yeah. and left town, right? He wanted to get out. But this album is a little bit of a coming home to the factory, to the people that, I mean, his dad was a factory worker, right? This is like a rootedness. And so that sort of, that little attention to class in America isn't just like a marketing move. It's an authenticity in Bruce. It is something that he had wanted to do, though. Like, he talks about the Animals as a big influence. The riff of Badlands is stolen right from an Animal song. He's named that. He's owned that a lot of times. But what he loved about them was there was this, like, this British band. There was this, like, attention to writing songs about the lower class and injustice. And there was something in him that he was like, that we can do that. We're allowed to do that. I want to do that. Because that's my roots. That's where I come from. That's me. Yeah. And I think that's that heartland rock, right? Like, it's coming out of a real person experience, along the maybe sort of mid America and the East Coast.
So what we wind up with is this, 10 track LP very nicely balanced from a timing perspective, with five tracks on each side and right under that sort of 45 minute LP maximum length of 42:55. It just is, it's so in that sweet spot of like music is being consumed on vinyl right now. And we're going to fill every inch of it. I also appreciate there's only one song that goes beyond 5 minutes. A little lengthy on Racing in the Street.
One of Ben's pet peeves.
One of my pet peeves. people who don't know when to stop their songs. And I will say, too, like, I don't know how you feel about The River, Greg. I own The River on vinyl, too, and I've been having a hard time with that album on vinyl because it is two albums and you got to flip it three times to listen to the whole thing. It's just a lot. And I find myself with these double LPs thinking like, was it just that the person had reached a certain kind of celebrity where they just said, now make it a double? Was there not an effective producer in the room saying, come on, we'll make a much better single album here if you just cut out this song or that song, save it for another time. I know it's a bit tangential here to what we're talking about tonight. All that to say, I guess I like this 10 track. It looks right to me in some sort of part of my head.
Yeah, I don't know why The River is like that or other double albums, but one thing you can tell for sure is that it's not an album in the way that Darkness on the Edge of Town is. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
You know, it's got a lot of pieces.
Thematically, you mean? Like just together?
Yeah, just like holding together. Concept? I mean, I was going to say, to me, Darkness on the Edge of Town is like a hair away from being a concept album.
Okay. Hmm. Yeah. We found that there's a fine line there, you know, that... Yeah. There's some we go, man, this could, is it? Well, it might be. They haven't said it is, but there's repeating themes musically, lyrically, like, yeah.
Clear beginning and an end.
And even if not a concept album per se, you know, a narrative for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was struck by the word darkness and the metaphor of it. And as I was reading through the lyrics, I didn't read this anywhere. I just discovered this. Every track on the album uses either the words darkness or night.
Oh.
Except one of them. One of them doesn't. The song Factory doesn't include those words, but every other song uses those words. Many of them use them multiple times. Huh. And I was just, it was like, once I noticed it, I just couldn't unsee it. Like, it was just everywhere for me through this album.
Didn't even pick up on that. And even, it's interesting you say that even Factory is all about the end of the day.
Yeah.
Coming home at the end of the day. So you still get that kind of darkness closing,
right.
You know,
right,
sunsetting.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting.
Still fits. If you're listening to this and thinking about where it falls in the timeline of his career, you may notice that the sound, the production value has shifted here too. There's a lot has been written about the challenges of breaking with your manager and then jumping into the studio and trying to make it up because you're sort of starting over again. I guess his guitar player, Steven Van Zandt, infamously thinks this was poorly produced, that these are some of Bruce's best songs, but the production was just not right, and they just never got the final sound that they were going for. I think he really wanted it to sound like a garage band. I think I read that somewhere this week. The person who put most of the time into it, like, burnt out near the end, and they had to bring in someone else, caused a delay in it being released. So it's fascinating. This rebirth, this new life also comes with struggle to make it all sound right too, and I think leads to some of the grittiness and the darkness. Actually, I like how it sounds despite Stevie's qualms with it, I guess.
I do too. I love the way it sounds. I think it's, you know, again, to contrast with Born to Run, you had that wall of sound on Born to Run, where it was just trying to be this giant sound. But this album feels like I can hear each of the instruments. And I know that they were meticulous in the studio trying to get it right. I know maybe Stevie didn't love it, but Bruce had a real vision of what he wanted. In fact, I was thinking of you, Mike, because there's been some conversations on your show about the sound of the snare drum, maybe particularly in the 70s. And I don't know if you appreciate the snare drum sound here or not, but there's a story. In fact, there's this scene. They made a DVD or a documentary called The Promise as well, where there's some footage from the recording of this album. And there's this scene where Max Weinberg, the drummer, is hitting the snare drum just repeatedly. And Bruce does not like the sound because he says he can hear the stick hitting the drum. It sounds like the stick.
Right. Yeah.
And he's yelling. Every time he hits it, he yells, stick, 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 and like over and over and over. And it, and I think I've read where Max talks about, like, they would do this for like days, like they just couldn't get the sound right. I thought you would appreciate that story.
I really do, and thank you for acknowledging my plight with this. I don't know what it is, but there's this kind of they don't use that sound that I referred to, kind of very, I don't know what it is. I wish we had a drum tech or somebody could kind of describe what's happening to me that I just don't prefer. But this is a very organic kind of crack that I prefer personally, as to put this kind of if you listen to, I think one of the best ones, one of the earliest ones, I think, like if you listen to Dark Side of the Moon, I love that album. It's one of my favorites. However, that is that sound, like that very produced kind of, almost like it's almost like it's got they played with the amplitude of each, like, I don't know exactly what it is technically, but it's, yeah, that kind of sound, but no, that's not here. And it fits very well with the whole feel of it. As being, the words you guys mentioned, gritty, raw, organic. I love it. Love it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
One thing that I've always been struck by in the E Street Band is their proficiency as musicians. For as big of a sound as they create, they're also really all in line and doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's funny to me to hear the guitarist say he longs for a garage band sound, because I don't think that proficiency that Bruce is known for, that, like, I have this vision in my head, we're trying to recreate this very specific thing. I don't think about that when I think about garage bands. I think about, like, crunching guitars and like slightly off key or out of tune instruments. So to have two people sort of at the mixing board longing for what in my head sounds like contrasting final results, I'm not surprised that it was a struggle to get it finalized too, if you had that tension in the mix as well.
There is more guitar here, though, as just like a feature than there was in Born to Run.
And less piano?
Yeah. I would say so. Just less instrument. I mean, there's only three sax solos on the whole album.
Yeah.
I felt like there were more guitar solos. Is that what you're getting at, Greg?
It is, yeah.
And other guitar, I'll say riffs, you know, like not solos but riffs, like, yeah, it's more guitar heavy
carrying the song.
And going back to Born to Run, you know, that big opening of the album, Thunder Road, with the piano coming in and really taking center stage, I think it sets the tone that the piano is going to be center stage a few times and opening a few tracks. We don't really get that here at all. I think there are some keys at the opening of Badlands, but it's blended in with everything else, so you kind of get the sense that this is going to be more of a band kind of thing. But yeah, for sure, on the guitar, and some absolutely killer licks on the guitar, like the solos are pretty awesome. I assume that's little Stevie, like, Does Bruce play those solos?
Bruce plays a good bit of those solos, actually.
He does, okay.
Yeah, this is an album where he kind of, people recognize, oh, this guy can play the guitar. I mean, he was known in Jersey as like one of the best guitar players around, but he hadn't really shown that in the other albums as much, and it really came out on this album.
Hmm. Cool. I don't know Bruce or Lil Stevie as guitar players enough to be able to tell who was doing what, and I didn't dig into it quite that much. So I was... Which was kind of cool because I was like, that could be either one, and they're both awesome. Like just really cool, really and unique solos. Like not a straight up blues solo or a straight up pattern or square. Like just really just innovative soloing. Really really good. Really liked it.
We've talked in generals a lot. Do you want to talk about which tracks stand out to us on this album?
I want to. Yes, I do. To answer your question, yes, Ben, yes, I do. I would like to start, and I'll tell you why. Not because I want to be first, but because I feel like you guys have expressed just a real passion for this album and for Bruce's music more than I have. So I want you guys to round it out, and I'm really interested, Ben. I know from doing this and from doing our, if you listened to our episode last week, was our re-rank, and we do like our top 10, and still Born to Run is one of your top 10 albums that we've reviewed thus far after 90 albums. And it's never really been on my top 10. I want to say about this album in general, I liked it personally a lot more than Born to Run. And this is from a guy, that I've never really done a deep dive into his music. I liked Born to Run, Ben, when we did, I've come back to it a few times and it's fine. But it never really grabbed me. I listened to this and even the first time I was like, ooh, oh, what's this? And there's a bit of a pull. Badlands is like kind of a strong starter. And then it goes up and down. Like you mentioned before, really good balance to, Racing in the Street, just like this gorgeous, quiet, gentle ballad full of emotion. I just found very taken by it. I felt the emotion. I liked the melodies very much. I liked the lyrics. I liked the sounds. It was a great listen, and I've enjoyed it far more than Born to Run, which I really didn't expect, because like you guys have said in your younger selves, not ever really getting Bruce until later, and I feel like I'm still kind of there in that stage. I'm slowly entering that middle age era of manhood where I become a hardcore Bruce fan, but I'm not there yet, guys.
Passage.
I'll join you soon, but in general, I really really like the songs, and I think, to me, if we're talking about specific songs, Badlands and Adam Raised a Cain are very hard biting tracks that really, I think, grabbed me, got my attention to really pay attention to this album. This is, and I'm talking about the first time, the first listen, because to me that's important. If I don't like an album the first time, it can really make it hard for me to enjoy it again. So I just wanted to kind of give an overview, because I want you guys to talk more than me for the rest of this, but that's kind of me, but I don't know, either one of you can go next, but I guess the question would be, what is it about this album, and choose something specific if you would, because you're right, Ben, we've talked, give us some specific examples on this album that made you really want to really enjoy it, or in your case, Greg, it went from one of your least favorites to your top three.
Well, maybe we need to go in descending order of Bruce appreciation. I still have very limited, experience with Bruce Springsteen. Like I've gotten really into Born to Run. I've definitely listened to The River a number of times, and I've listened to this one, but that's kind of it. I don't know if it's preservation. I know that we've still got a number of his albums to tackle on this list, and I don't want to jump too far ahead. I've been told, based on conversations I've had with other people about what I enjoy about Bruce, that Nebraska is probably going to be in my sweet spot whenever I get to Nebraska.
Okay.
But this one has not, as I mentioned earlier, has not grabbed me in the same way as Born to Run. And I think it is the darkness. I appreciate the authenticity, but I find myself longing for something a bit poppier. And I feel a little embarrassed to say that, but that's the way I think I lean. I lean a bit more Stevie Wonder than the Doors in our journey so far. And
I like that.
And so so this one is, I'm still trying to figure out what I think about it. There's some tracks that I really, really like, and it's interesting, Greg. I think you listed Candy's Room as one of your least favorite Bruce Springsteen tracks, because that one pulls me in a way. I don't know if it's just the like pulsing, drum repetition that it begins with, and it does have that like underlying piano. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's got a bit of Born to Run in it. It also has a darkness and some kind of maybe twisted male-female relationship stuff going on in there too. But that's the one that stands out to me as like, oh, there's something complicated and complex here about this darkness that makes me want to know more. Candy's Room is the one that kind of makes me think, oh, I actually maybe do like this more than I think. And I bet if I spent a little bit more time with it, it'd probably be pretty high up there on my list of these albums too. So I don't know. It's a good table setter for you there. Mike and I are on bass. Greg, bring us home. Whatever you want to do.
Oh man, there's so much I want to say. But I think you touched a nerve with it being complicated and complex. I think that's part of what is drawing me into it.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that I didn't listen to it as an album. Like when I first was listening to Springsteen, I basically just put on like Spotify, like all the albums and sure. on shuffle, yeah. you know, and I like several of the tracks here, but to sit down and listen to it as an album, I wouldn't even have done because I did not like Candy's Room. And I also didn't care for Adam Raised a Cain.
Right.
There was just something in the way Bruce sounded, like he sounds angry or something. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't drawn to that sort of musically, right? Just listening to it casually. But Promised Land is so good. Badlands is so good. I think Darkness on the Edge of Town. I love the sound of Factory. The sound of many of these songs, it really appeals to me. But when I sat down and really just started savoring it, you know, it's a difference between like chugging down a gas station coffee and or sitting with like a carefully crafted cup of coffee and enjoying it. Mm. When I did that, the complexity and the what I want to say are like the juxtapositions here of some of the lyrics are just dark. Like, this guy's lost everything. This guy's given up everything. That people are going to take everything away from you. Like it's, and then sometimes in the same song, he's got this, but I believe in faith and I believe in hope and I believe in love. He says that in Badlands, he uses that exact language from 1 Corinthians 13. He talks about standing on the hill and fighting, you know, he's not going to give up. There's this like, even in the song, like Adam Raised a Cain, like is it deterministic? Like I'm going to just become what everyone has been before me. No, there's this feel of like, I have a choice to become something different than what I was given. And that feels so hopeful. So there's this like tension that's complex and challenging and demands a lot of the listener, I think, that really draws me in here. And Candy's Room, Ben, I appreciate what you said about it because that opened that up a little bit more for me. But for the most part, I've just heard Candy's Room as, well, first of all, I don't like the drumming that you're talking about. Those those 16th notes on the snare that go on forever. I'm just like, somebody please stop that.
That's Max on his jazz kit.
I also don't like Bruce's weird whispering at the beginning, but hey, that's just me.
Oh, yeah, that part is a little weird.
but I do think it's complex. Like if you actually read the lyrics, you kind of have to think like, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. You know, and it does draw you in to sort of, a deeper story. I want to say a word about Prove It All Night too. So, you know, Prove It All Night was actually the first single from the album. We didn't talk about this, but the singles from this album were total flops. Like nothing charted very well at all. The album did better, but the singles were awful. And that actually kind of speaks to the album, doesn't it? Like it's more of an album than it is a hit producer.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
But this was the Prove It All Night was the first single. And I've never really loved it because when I hear Bruce singing Prove It All Night over and over, I've had a hard time like getting past the idea that it just sounds like a sort of macho song of like, you know, I don't know, I'll prove how manly I am all night long or whatever. Like,
right. Yeah.
Yuck. I don't need that. but I have to give a shout out to my friend Matt here, who he and I met for breakfast last week and talked through all these songs. He's a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, so he helped me out a little bit here. You know, thinking about night more as a metaphor of this thing that Bruce is going through, and what is it exactly that he's trying to prove? And there's this anecdote that I wanted to share as part of this conversation. Maybe you guys have heard it, but you know, Bruce didn't want to promote this album at all. He actually told the record company no promotion, no advertising. And of course, they didn't agree to that. but they did scale it way back from Born to Run. But it was selling so poorly that eventually they came back and said, it's not working. We have to advertise more and you need to do some press. And one of the things they did is he had a show coming up in L.A. at the Forum. And so they put this big billboard up over the Sunset Strip with a big picture of his face. It's from the album cover, his face. And it said, Bruce Springsteen, Darkness on the Edge of Town. And sometime that summer in 1978, he and Clarence and I think Gary Talent, the bass player, saw this when they were in L.A. They saw this billboard and they were like, they hated it. They hated it. And so Bruce led a charge. They climbed up some tower with spray paint. and they defaced this billboard. One of the things they did is Bruce himself wrote E Street Band on it because he felt like that's not right. It shouldn't just say Bruce Springsteen. I think that's a really cool thing for him to do. But the reason I bring this story up now is that they, in huge letters across the whole thing, what they wrote was Prove It All Night. And I think that's an interesting choice. And I think what it's saying is like, don't trust the billboard. Like, don't trust the machine. Don't trust the pop glitter and glamour and the success that the record company wants me to be. Trust my authenticity. Come and see for yourself. I'll prove it. That this is authentic to me, not some record company shtick. And I just, that to me really speaks to like the authenticity that Bruce is after here. And that song, Prove It All Night, took on a whole new meaning for me when I started thinking about it.
Yeah.
Thanks for that insight on that, Greg. I love that a lot. That's really great.
He has a story about his first trip to Europe or London or something, right? Where his like face was plastered all over town in a sort of celebrity way that he just like couldn't perform. He was so bothered by the way they had tried to sell him before he even arrived there. And partially because he felt like, I haven't been here to show you who I am yet, so don't put my face up all over town thinking you know me, because I haven't been here yet. And
because I haven't proven it. He hasn't proven it yet.
It seems like a parallel there to the banner in L.A. That's really fascinating.
You know, we didn't talk about the fact that Elvis died. His hero died in this interim period, too. And
78, and, right? Or 76?
77. Elvis died in August of 77.
Okay.
And you know what Elvis had become at the end of his career. And I think Bruce was terrified that the celebrity was going to make him become what Elvis had become, make him lose all of his authenticity and become a puppet of himself or a puppet for the music industry or whatever. And I think that's an underlying part of the narrative that I think is important to recognize here. This is like why it's so important for him to stand on the hill and fight, because he's just like, you're not going to take my authenticity away from me.
And coming out of you're not going to take my first three albums from me in this way
too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Legal,
right.
Yeah.
Legal proceedings too.
Wow. I sometimes, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that. Sometimes I forget, because and I wasn't around yet, about the impact that Elvis's death had on so many people in general, but also artists in particular. Like, what a huge impact his life had, and when all of a sudden he was gone too soon. Even though, yes, his career had, and his person had really changed and kind of dissipated, how that rocked so many people and how that affected so many people, because I didn't experience that. Yeah, I haven't experienced that really with anyone, you know, in that way from start to finish. You know, maybe, I mean, in Canada we lost a treasure in Gord Downie, the lead singer of the Tragically Hip, a few years ago, and that was probably the closest we would come to, you know, an artist that we grew up with, mm-hmm. that was, I mean, in this case, still making music and still making waves politically, socially in our country, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden, you know, was gone, mm-hmm. and there was such a lead up because we knew he was sick. So, but Elvis, I missed that. So I think that just adds to the whole gamut of emotions that he is conveying in this collection of songs, this story he's telling. I hadn't even considered that. That's a really good point. Mm. Wow.
The trajectory of his career at this point, I'm forgetting how we get from a darker album that doesn't sell very well to some of the meteoric things that come later. Is this a case of him saying this dark period of my life is closing with this album and I'm going to step forward now in these next projects in a different kind of tone? Some people find their voice in the darkness and just stay there. And he didn't really. I mean, you can still hear some of this in the music that came later, but was there a chapter closing here too?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a degree, the sort of standing on the hill and fighting for, you know, some of the control and the integrity kind of piece. It was this is like he made that decision. You know what I mean? He didn't have to make it as in some ways. He didn't have to make it again, at least not in the same way. And yet there is a sort of pendulum swing. So you get The River next, which. Has some of the Cutting Room Floor songs from this era, but also some other stuff, and it's got a lot of happier tunes on it as well, sort of a mix. And then the next thing after that is the album you mentioned, Nebraska, which is a huge pendulum swing back towards like not what the radio wants at all.
Mm-hmm. Followed by Born in the USA, which is his biggest
commercial
success.
Exactly.
Right?
So I don't know that the darkness stays with him. However, I think what he's learned in the darkness and that sort of like, I'm going to pay attention to my roots and I'm going to sing for the people, the real people who come to see me play. And I want to connect with them. That's always what he wants to do. He always wanted to connect with real people. I think he brought that and that has stayed with him all through his career, whether he's singing something fun on Born in the USA or something darker on like Tom Joad or something like that. He's learned from this experience.
Reminds me of one of Mike's favorites, John Mayer, and his like, I need to write a few versions of Your Body as a Wonderland so that I can make the artsy concept album next time that doesn't sell any copies at all. gotta just keep swinging back and forth between those two places.
Right.
I don't know that Bruce has ever said that, but yeah.
Well, like Beck. Beck is known for that. He will do Odelay, which was huge and poppy and fun, and then he did Mutations, was like, you know, way down, and then we have Midnight Vultures, and then we have Sea Change, and he just keeps doing that until finally he gets to Morning Phase, which is that kind of softer, but it wins him Album of the Year. So it was kind of like he'll do he knows how to write the hit, but then he'll do an album of quote the music he wants to make that might not sell. I hear you on that. I think there's a lot of artists who have done that. Interesting.
Another thing that I think is really important for me here, is, you know, you mentioned that I'm a pastor, so I can't help but hear like elements of faith in this album pretty strong. I mentioned that he says faith, hope, and love in Badlands. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hope throughout here. Of course, Adam raised a Cain is biblical imagery. Actually, he starts the song off talking about remembering his baptism, which I think is really cool. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's Racing in the Street ends with, he says he needs to wash the sins off of their hands. So that feels like a kind of baptism, like, as well. I just think there's something really neat there. And then this whole theme of darkness in general, I was watching his, he did a VH1 Storytellers episode. And he was singing another one of his songs called Jesus Was an Only Son. And as he's talking about the song, he says, Jesus was an only son as he walked up Calvary Hill. And then Bruce says, that's his proving ground. That's his darkness on the edge of town. And I found that to be a really interesting way for Bruce to use his own album title. He's like telling you what he meant by it, right? And I had referred to this album as a kind of Holy Saturday album. Like, it's in between, right? Like, it's sort of that, like, the bad stuff has happened and good stuff is on the way, and we're just in this liminal sort of space in between. That kind of feels like the darkness on the edge of town.
That's interesting.
There's something about what you said earlier, Mike, and the authenticity of Lemonade and Blue that requires you to pause in those liminal spaces, right, Greg? Like, that you don't just quickly move to the next pop hit, but you spend some time dwelling there, savoring that. And I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on why there's a need there, but maybe it is just about, like, not always pretending like everything is fine or everything is perfect. It's more to chew on. Dang it. Just having a lot of really deep, thoughtful pastoral journey here through Darkness on the Edge of Town tonight.
I have a question for you guys. I noticed that it had previously been at number 150 on the Rolling Stone list, and for like every time. And then it was 91. Like, what happened?
Well, we see a big shift in the published list of the voters who voted for these albums. And Ben has the coffee table book from the original 2003 list, which was the first list. And it goes through all the voters, and it's very steeped in people who grew up in the 60s and 70s, a lot of journalists, a lot of music critics, a lot of people in the industry, mostly white men of a certain age, very few women, very few people who are not white. And that's where you get that real foundation of that kind of 60s and 70s rock and folk rock in that first list. The second list really doesn't change much, because the 2012 list was basically a merging of the 500 and their greatest of that decade, the 2000, the aught decade, if you will. Mm-hmm. When we move to the 2020 list, they pull a whole new group of people, people who were, you know, some of them barely out of diapers in 2003. more women, more younger artists, more people of color, you know, like, so you get this shift on what's significant to people in their formative years, and even in their songwriting years. You get like some very well-known artists who voted, and it's like, okay, who influenced them in like their first few albums? Now they're in album number, you know, 8 of a very successful career. So I think that's a big part of it. And as we move through ahead in time, and more people maybe now in their 40s and 50s who this would have affected them more maybe than Born to Run, because I think it caught, as we talked about the beginning of, you know, Heartland Rock, the beginning of coming into the 80s, I think Born to Run is maybe catching people who were kind of at a different, does that make sense at all? That's my take on it anyways. And I think we saw some bands where they had albums flip. So
yeah,
like we saw that even with the Beatles where Sgt. Pepper's was like number one and it drops over 20 spots, yet Revolver shoots way up. Or we saw it with where like some go down and some go up. And I think, I mean, every generation is going to have resonance with different things, but I think that's what it comes down to. It's the resonance, how it resonates with this brand new, I mean, it's almost two decades removed, these two, the 2003 and the 2020, right? 17 years. So that would be my unofficial, unauthorized opinion on why there's that shift.
If we skip ahead to any other albums for this artist in the top 500, you can see this interesting trend here. Born to Run, maybe we'll set aside because it stayed right around 20 for the different iterations. But Darkness kind of flipped places with Born in the USA. So we're valuing kind of authenticity over pop hits. Mm-hmm. And Nebraska takes a big jump up. Again, maybe a more authentic, transparent, artsy album. Jumps up 100 spots, maybe not quite 100, but in that ballpark. And The River falls off completely. Another sort of chart-topping album of his. So, yeah, I wonder too about, you know, the voting for this list happened as the pandemic was hitting us. A lot of people bored at home trying to figure out what really is important to us as well. And I think there's something about the different demographics of the voters this time that said we are going to prioritize music that made a difference and not just music that was popular. And
okay,
yeah.
If you've listened before, you know that we have a playlist, Spotify playlist. Mm-hmm. Greg, I don't know if you've been anticipating this or dreading this, but when we have a guest, we really like to turn to our guests and ask them to pick what songs will go on. So if you would, to put you on the spot, if you could pick two songs, either your favorites or two that you would represent this album, you know, what two tracks would you have us put on that list from this album?
I have been sort of wavering on what I knew I was going to have to be asked this question, and I've been losing sleep about it. I think I gotta go with, I'm definitely gonna go with Badlands.
Okay.
It's just as the opening track, I feel like it's a sort of a announcement that, you know, we're in a whole new place. This is a whole new Bruce Springsteen. He sounds different. The music sounds different. The lyrics right from the beginning tell you you're not in New Jersey anymore. Yeah. And it just represents this like huge pivot point. So I think you got to have that. Plus it just rocks. And then I was going to go with maybe The Promised Land or Darkness on the Edge of Town, which is the last track. But I think after I've been really thinking about this whole Prove It All Night thing, and that he defaced this billboard with this, that it meant that much to him to say, like, I'm trying to prove who I really am, and prove my chops and my authenticity apart from all the other stuff. I think that really encapsulates for me the spirit of this album. And so I'm gonna pick Prove It All Night as the other, which was the first single. So I think it makes sense there too.
I like those choices, and they're now entrenched on that playlist for all time.
Oh, good! I can sleep again now, right?
Yeah,
you can sleep again now.
I want to comment on "Prove It All Night," and I know you talked about it a bit, so I don't want to beat a dead horse, but it really grabbed, despite it being a little repetitive at times, with him repeating that phrase over and over. It is so catchy and so good. This thing that Bruce does, these harmonies that he record, like it's him harmonizing with himself, obviously in the studio. I'm pretty sure it's his voice backing his own voice up, but it's a great sound. Like I've heard it both ways. I've heard it where you hear somebody harmonize himself and it just doesn't work. You hear it with someone else and it sounds great. He's done it very well. So I really like that. And it's a very, if there's a quintessential Bruce Springsteen sound, it's in that sweet spot for me. It's nice.
I love that.
is really cool because we talked about, you know, this starting kind of a little subgenre, and then that subgenre kind of phasing out. And of course, as all artists, you know, you move through different eras and you move through different spaces. So that really is a good backdrop to this question. And we like to ask, you know, this album's now, you know, getting close to 50 years old, you know, 45 years old. What has aged well? What hasn't? How has it stood the test of time? Ben, you want to weigh in first on that?
Boy, this feels awfully similar to talking about Neil Young just on our last album review, but I feel like Bruce has never really sounded like his peers. You know, maybe a few that you mentioned in this subgenre have some similar overtones, but no one can really match his voice or the combined sound of E Street Band. And so it feels a little bit strange to talk about whether it's held up, because it's still around. It's still plugging away. It's still sounding pretty much like this. But again, not like anyone else who's touring right now. So, boy, this is finding this question tougher tonight than I usually do. because, I'd be surprised if someone came out with Darkness on the Edge of Town today and it did well, but it didn't really do well when it came out a long time ago either. So,
true.
perhaps it's aged just as it was supposed to, in that it is a beloved album by fans, still speaking what it's meant to speak today. And yeah, I don't know, maybe this is a default we use too often, but Jason Crane reminding us that, you know, if the instrumentation is what's still being used to make music, it's not aging. We're still making songs with guitar, bass, drums, and maybe a little less saxophone and harmonica these days, but still rock and roll being made like this.
I was thinking a lot about this, because so, sometimes you guys have used the word relevance, you know, is it relevant? And I was really struggling with that, what that means for a rock album from 1978, yeah. Right? And I was thinking about the fact that, I mean, it's not getting a lot of airtime or anything. Kids aren't, you know, right, jamming this on Spotify very much. However,
that we know of, maybe they are.
Sure, that we know of, yeah. I was thinking though, Ben might know this, that here in where we live in State College, what we call Happy Valley, I don't know why it is, but every, you know, we get 100,000 people crammed into a stadium for a home football game, and every home football game they play Badlands.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm obviously not a big enough Penn State football fan to know that. That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Alongside, you know, a bunch of hip hop stuff that's just from the last couple of years and some other oldies as well. Like there's some other songs in there, but Badlands is always on the playlist, and I don't know why, but I just find that really fascinating. Hmm. But anyway, that's maybe neither here nor there, but it is interesting. I think for me, it's like the themes are still really relevant.
Yes.
In particular, you've heard me really kind of focus in on authenticity, and you know, where we're in this world right now where people are just like curating a version of themselves that they want everyone to see, and really carefully trying to do that. And a sort of pendulum swing to like be real, you know, like where it's like, no, just show up the way you are. I feel like this album has something to say to us in that sort of tension, about really kind of fighting for your integrity and your authenticity and who you are and your roots and where you came from and all of that. And I think the themes are really relevant. And I also just wanted to add too, that, if you're a Springsteen fan, this album remains very relevant. So he continues to play a bunch of these songs regularly. In the top five most played Springsteen songs in concerts, two of them are from this album.
Wow.
And that's a huge catalog. He's got a ton of songs, right? So it's like really important in the Springsteen canon for sure.
All right, Mike, clean up hitter here.
Okay, sonically, the kind of
snare drum.
No, snare drum's good. It's all right. The very out front, loud, with a little reverb saxophone solo is not something that we do much anymore in music. So that,
right.
And you, Ben, you know, I'm a saxophone player. So, or at least I was at one point.
No disrespect to Clarence.
I love Clarence Clemons is a god in the rock world. No offense at all. His solos are awesome. That sound just isn't used as much anymore. So that's gonna stick it firmly in a certain era, or a pretty big era. But we just don't do that as much in music anymore. So that's one thing that I noticed right away. The guitar sounds, the piano, even the harmonica. I mean, there's a lot of folk rock, indie rock today that are back That's to true. Those yeah, acoustics. Yeah, absolutely. So I don't mind that. The piano, so there's a bit of organ almost, and as we move into some of the other, even into the river, a little almost like a Zydeco sound in some of this that again has its place in different music. So a lot of it... a lot of it is still found in now, maybe not on, you know, pop hit radio, or there's no vocoder, so we don't have that. But I think there's a lot here. I will say, and you're right, Ben, when we talked about Neil Young, no one's ever going to sound like The Boss. So we take that out of the equation, because he's just always going to be Bruce, and there's nobody like him. You're going to know it's him from the first time he opens his mouth on the track. So that doesn't really age, because he's timeless in that sense. So I think it does pretty well. And I think, yeah, they're going to play this. They're going to play, I mean, Bruce Springsteen in general is still, he's still in the media. He's still touring, as we know from personal experience, Greg, from just a few weeks ago. He's still very much a relevant artist. And a relevant cultural figure. So I think because of all that, it does quite well. I think it stands up quite well. And I think, you know, even if we think about his catalog, like Born in the USA played all the time, Born to Run played all the time, you know, so to play Badlands at a football game, I think it fits. So yeah, no, I think it does well. Better than I thought. When I'm going to push play on here's another Bruce album. Let's see what happens. And even I was like, oh wow, this is good. So
cool.
Yeah. Aged pretty well, just like Bruce. I think Bruce,
yeah, might, about it,
man, he, boy, he, I think he looks better now than some of his other younger pictures. Yeah. He's definitely taking care of himself. I don't want to get another sidetrack.
They say that thing about that teenagers sometimes need to grow into their bodies. And like, I feel like he's grown into his voice. Like, it now feels
yeah,
like he's yeah, at the point where his voice is supposed to sound.
Well, I said that when we did Born to Run, I was like,
yeah,
Ben, he's like 26.
Yeah.
When right, he does Born to Run, he sounds like he's 55, and not just the sound quality of his voice, but the lyrical content. It's like,
right. Chiseled. Grizzled. Yeah.
Who is this guy who is yeah, writing about these experiences and this kind of whole persona that, like, it's just way ahead of his time. Yeah. Wow. Great. That was a good segment. I like that. that went well. So let's talk. I like actually that we already talked about some of his other albums, because we'll talk about the ranking here. So this was 150 on every, let's say 150 on every previous version of this list, now jumps up 60 spots to 91. So Greg, this can be a hard question to answer if you're not as living and breathing this list as Ben and I are week to week, day to day. But what do you think about the ranking? This is the 91st greatest album of all time. how do you just... A knee-jerk reaction. How does that make you feel?
I mean, I feel like it should be higher, but I mean, that's, okay, you know, through my Springsteen glasses, right? I guess I don't have the context that you guys have for that, but
yeah,
it's tricky. But I will say, what was Born to Run? It was like 21
on this list.
21.
Yeah.
So what, 70 spots different? For me, that doesn't feel accurate. Like, honestly, Born to Run it's great. It's got some amazing singles on it, and I know it carries some weight just because of, like, it's got that teenage sort of rock and roll runaway thing. But I feel like this album has a lot more depth and meaning. And so you see it jump up, what, 59 spots from before. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the future it would actually jump up more, and Born to Run might, I don't know. I just think they should be closer together, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I agree with those statements. I'm not just saying this because of the jump we see in the ranking of this particular album, but because of the tone of it and just the way the tone of our culture has changed in the last decade. I think it makes sense that this has more relevance now and more people would be claiming that it has had an impact on their life or on their musical taste, on their musical expression as well. We're seeing that more, that exactly what we talked about, that authenticity more than just, you know, I want to just take a step back. We talked about the other albums. There's four Bruce Springsteen albums that are no longer on the Rolling Stone list that used to be. And we saw a lot of artists where it was almost like Rolling Stone said, well, we have to put every Beatles album on, so just slot them in. We have to put every Stones album. Okay, who are some other major artists in our... Okay, The Boss. Well, okay, let's slot all The Boss albums in. And I'm making this up. I'm not saying that this is actually what happened. So don't... nobody call Rolling Stone and tattle on me. But
although we would be willing to interview them if they want to come on the program.
I think we might be a... if that happened. But... we saw a lot of that in the first list, even into the 2012 list, where it seemed that there was just this, well, here are the foundational artists, so let's get them represented. Let's get their whole catalog represented. Then we get into this new list, and it seems that they were cutting a lot of that, where you see artists that had maybe 8 albums or 6 albums, now they're pared down to only a few. And the ones that are left are very significant, but it's almost like, or for me, I felt like, all the albums were there just for the sake of them all being there. And I see that even with the Bruce Springsteen albums that aren't, four of them, like The River's not even on anymore. So if, for example, if this spawned the Heartland genre, or if this is one that is really inspiring musicians today or in the last decade, then it makes perfect sense that it's bumped up. So I don't know if I necessarily need this one to be higher, because if it's here because of those reasons, then it makes perfect sense that it's here. And it makes perfect sense that it moved the rate that it did. I'm actually more surprised that... Born in the USA dropped so much, because that's, as much as, you know, it kind of hinges a lot on kind of one or two songs and kind of the as you said, the pinnacle of that subgenre, it's still very significant. So it's interesting. Interesting, but I'm okay with it here, and I'm more interested in the movement of it than where actually it is. That's what interests me about this one. I don't think I've ever said that before, but that's what interests me about this one.
I'm feeling a little bit like your surprise when I said that I liked Bowie's Hunky Dory more than any of the albums we've listened to so far, Mike, because...
I was.
Yeah, I did not expect you to say that this evening.
Okay.
Ben,
after 40, after for like an old married couple, after 40 years, we can still surprise each other now and then. It's still full of surprises.
I still love Born to Run, and maybe, like I said earlier, my default is to something a bit more upbeat, poppy, and radio friendly. So it doesn't surprise me to see them ordered in this way. I can't quite fully comprehend why the other Springsteen albums fall in the way that they do or raise in the way that they do. And it'll be really fun, I think, to walk through those together to see what's going on here exactly. We didn't say this when we went through all the other albums on this list, that he's lost three out of what one, at one point, I guess his high point was seven. Mm-hmm. He's had eight total on the multitude of lists. Mm-hmm. So he's been dinged a little bit harder than some of the other artists where you were saying, Mike, like, let's just slot them all in here. We continue to go back to this point that authenticity mm-hmm. really does make something great. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, like, Darkness deserves to be higher because right. it is so yeah. authentic and raw. That would be the one reason I would say it really should be a lot higher on this list. I'm surprisingly fairly content with it right here. Maybe by the time we get through all these Bruce albums, I'll be like, why is it at 91? It really should be somewhere else. But for tonight, at least, I'll control my feelings and just say it's fine.
You saw Bruce recently in the E Street Band. So where was that?
Got to see Bruce. This was actually my third show. And he and the band were here in State College about 6 weeks ago.
Did they play Beaver Stadium, or where did they play?
No, it's indoors, next door to Beaver Stadium at the Bryce Jordan Center. It's where a lot of concerts are held here in State College.
Is that is that the basketball stadium, I guess?
It is. Okay. Yep. It is. Yeah. And it was a sold-out show.
Okay.
And I actually had decided not to go because the ticket prices were just probably a little bit beyond what I could justify. And
it started around $200, right, for the nosebleeds.
Yeah. And there was like this whole Ticketmaster thing with getting in a queue. And then by the time I was able to buy tickets, I actually got into the queue and got my number came up. But they were going to be like $300 or more each, I think, and I just couldn't do it. So I had decided not to, and then a friend of ours had somebody canceled, and so they were like, "Do you want to go?" And I was like, "Absolutely!" So shout out to my friend Liz. Thanks for that, Liz. Oh, wow. So that was amazing, and it was a really great show. You know, one of the things about Bruce is that he does prove it. You know, like we've talked about
right.
proving it.
Yeah.
And the way he does that is not so much in the studio as he does when you see him in person. When I saw Bruce the first time in 2014 in Hershey, in a huge arena, okay, and I was very skeptical. I'm like, I can barely see that guy up there. This is going to be a terrible experience. He made it feel like it was just me and him in the room.
Wow.
And and I was hooked. Like, from that moment, I was just like, wow, this is incredible. This guy wants to connect with me. He wants me to be here. I can tell. And he wants there to be a connection between us. And he works hard to earn that and to show that. And that's still there. I mean, he's older now. He's not. I was telling Ben, he doesn't talk as much in between the songs. I don't think he goes off script quite as much. And he didn't stage dive this time. You know, but the energy is still there, and the connection, the most important thing is the connection is still there. And so it felt like we got in there and I blinked and it was over, you know, that's what it felt like, but it was over. I think it was over 3 hours long. I mean, it's still, it was an incredible show.
Wow. Was there anything that really surprised you in that show that you didn't expect?
Not really. One of my favorite things about Bruce live is that they are constantly tinkering with the set list. So it's not like some artists where you go and it's the same set list they played in Cleveland and in Cincinnati and in Chicago. You know, it's not like that with Bruce typically.
Right.
You're going to come and you're going to get the same opening few songs and usually the same closing few songs, but the middle can be real different. But this show, this tour, he didn't do as much changing. And I think, again, part of that might be just the age of everybody in the band and everything, right?
Yeah.
So that surprised me a little, that it was a little bit more on script than what I was used to. But still, I guess in another way, I was surprised that even at his age, just how hard he works and how fit he is and how how much energy he exudes. I mean, I'm 47 and I feel like I'd be done after the first 10 songs. You know? So that surprises me, and it shows me that it's coming from, it's physical, but it's also spiritual. Like, it's just coming from a deep place in him.
There was some question about whether or not they'd play, right? Because they had canceled a few shows prior just to illness.
Right.
And there were some folks wondering if the less conversational Bruce was due to that that recent illness. They were like, let's just plow through.
Wow. It could be. It could be.
But you also said, Greg, as we were talking before we got on tonight, maybe he is just getting to that age that we better hurry up and see him before he just decides I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
I'm done. So, he's aged better than Elvis so far. So,
for
we'll
sure.
Cross our fingers.
That's right.
Oh, wow. Well, guys, this has been just an absolute pleasure. Greg, thank you so much for sharing this time with us. It's really been great. I know I said it a few times, but we're just delighted to have you and to hear your passion about Bruce Springsteen and about this music. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Really, I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And you'll have to come over sometime. We'll pull out some Bruce vinyl and we'll just sip a beer and talk about what makes it great.
Let's do it. Let's do it for sure.
Give me a 10-hour warning, guys, and I'll be there. I'll drive down.
Six, Mike. It's only six. You can make it.
Oh, man. You haven't driven with my family, Ben. I'm kidding. On that note, Ben, tell us what we got coming up next week.
Yeah. It feels like, I don't know what it is, but we've almost experienced whiplash with the way that this list has been of late. The albums just shift genre like so wildly. Up next here at number 92 is Axis Bold as Love by the Jimi Hendrix Experience. And it's going to be an interesting thing to go into some 60s experimental psychedelic rock after coming out of this Heartland rock here.
Heartland rock, that is certainly not.
So neither of us take acid, so we're going to have a fairly sober reflection on this music.
Well, it's a week away, so we'll see. anyways, thank you, Greg. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
Thank you, though, listening at home. We really appreciate it. Until next time, we hope you continue to be well. We hope you take care of yourselves and those around you, those close to you. And of course, we certainly hope you'll join us again right here on the Sound Logic Podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you like what you hear, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and write a review.
Send us a message at our Facebook page, on Instagram, or through our SoundLogic Podcast Twitter feed. Thanks for listening.